In Pali, we have several words that we use when we talk about this thing that we call meditation, but we don't often use a word that is parallel to the word meditation. But in English, it's a really good word. So if you think about this word, often it doesn't quite jive with our understanding of what we're doing when we sit down. Because meditation means, in some sense, to ponder or to consider, to examine. And often when we come to sit and think that we're practicing meditation, we're not actually meditating at all. Sometimes we're sitting and we're hoping for something, or we're clinging to something, looking for a peaceful, calm state. Sometimes we're trying to push ourselves or push away thoughts. Sometimes we're trying to just quiet the mind. Oh, I want to make my mind quiet. And we work hard and work hard to make our mind quiet. But that's not included in the definition of the word meditation. And this is important, because what I practice, what I want to share with you, and what Sarat has practiced, what we practice under the Buddha, is a form of meditation. It's not that we're going to think, but it's that we're going to examine, and we're going to look at, and we're going to be with reality, with our experience. We're not going to try to create anything, or to chase away anything, or to be anything other than what we already are. We're just going to try to clear up and to see more clearly the things that are already right here in front of us. So this is how I want you to understand what we're doing. For those of you who have never practiced before, this is called vipassana. Vipassana means to see clearly. So it doesn't mean we're not going to practice to find some special state. We're going to practice to see our minds, and to understand our minds clearly, to understand our minds for what they are. The method that we use to see clearly is generally understood to be the four foundations of mindfulness, or the four satipatthana, which many of you may have heard of. Now, there are many ways to go about seeing clearly, and many different techniques, but the reason why we say to see clearly you have to use, or we always use the four foundations of mindfulness, is because when we say the four satipatthana, or the four foundations of mindfulness, it's really not some specific practice. It's just a way of understanding the whole of reality, because all parts of our experience fit into the four foundations of mindfulness. Now, the reason we use the four foundations of mindfulness is because it's a framework or a categorization of the parts of our experience, so that when something comes up, when we experience something, when something arises in our frame of vision, we know what it is, or we know approximately where it fits into reality. So when we hear a dog barking, we don't think of a dog. We don't think of it as a dog, because we know dog isn't in the four foundations of mindfulness. So therefore, dog isn't in the ultimate reality of the experience. But hearing is. The sound that arises at the ear is real. That's a part of the four foundations of mindfulness, and therefore it's a part of reality. We also know right away where that fits in. When we hear something, we know that that's hearing. We hear the dog barking. We hear our dog barking to be let in, and so on. And we have all these ideas about it. But the core reality of it is only the hearing. And so we right away catch it to be hearing. We know where it fits in with the four satipatthana, and we know how to deal with it. This makes it easy in our minds to understand what is real and what is not real, and allows us to quickly establish a clear awareness of the object. So this is why we have this framework. This is why we say to see clearly, we use the four foundations of mindfulness. The four foundations, so this is how I'm going to explain the meditation, and this is the meditation that I'm going to have you to practice with me. So the four foundations of mindfulness are the body, the feelings, the mind, and the Dhamma. Now, Dhamma I'm not going to translate yet, I'll explain it in a second. Body is the from our head to our feet, everything that we think of generally as us. So in modern society we think that's it. I am my body. The brain is what thinks, and the heart is what lives, and all of this is who I am. Now in Buddhism this is only a part, and it's the part that is that we can see, that we can experience on a physical level. But there's more to reality than that. So the body is this physical experience, and moreover, it's the experience of the physical body. So when we feel the foot moving, or when we feel the stiffness in our chair or on the sitting mat, we feel stiffness in our back, we feel the pressure in our stomach. Whenever we feel a feeling in the body, the feeling of our tongue touching the roof of our mouth, and so on, every piece of our experience, our hands touching one another when we're sitting, our feet, our legs touching the floor, and so on. All of this experience of the physical, that's what we mean by body. Feelings is our basic sensory experience of these phenomena, the pressures and so on, all of the physical parts. So it can be a pleasant feeling. It can be an unpleasant feeling. For instance, when your legs are pressing hard against the floor, or when your back is stiff or so on, it can be an unpleasant feeling. Sometimes when you're sitting and you've had a good meal and the room is warm and so on, you might feel a pleasant feeling. But mostly we'll feel simply a neutral feeling. So when the pressure against the floor, the pressure against our back, the pressure of our hands touching, just gives us a neutral feeling. We don't feel pleasure because of it, and we don't feel displeasure. We can also have mental feelings. So we might feel happy in the mind when we think of something, or we might feel unhappy in the mind when we think of something, and so on. Or when we experience something, when we have loud noises around, we might get upset and therefore feel an unpleasant feeling in the mind. And sometimes we might hear something nice. Maybe you hear someone say something nice to you, and you feel happy as a result. So there's pleasure in the mind. So there's the physical feelings and the mental feelings, but it means happy, unhappy, or neutral. This is what we mean by feeling. Everything that we experience will have an associated feeling with it. If it's not pleasant or unpleasant, it will be a neutral feeling. This is the second part of reality, the second part of our practice. The third part is the mind itself. And the mind can be understood in many ways. It can be formed in many ways. It can be in many different states. So sometimes the mind is distracted. Sometimes the mind is very focused. Sometimes the mind is loud and chaotic. Sometimes the mind is quiet. Sometimes the mind is clear. Sometimes the mind is not clear. Sometimes it's confused. Sometimes it's angry. Sometimes it's greedy. Sometimes it's caring and loving and so on. There's all sorts of states of the mind. Now, for the purposes of meditation, we're just going to understand it as that which experiences an object, that which examines the object. So, when you have these experiences, first you have the object. For instance, the sensation of our legs and our bottom against the floor when we're sitting, and then we have the feeling of it. Then we also have a thought about it, or the examining mind about it. It can be judgments, it can be recognitions, when we recognize it to be, oh, this is a feeling, or this is my stomach rising, this is my stomach falling. When we hear a sound and we think about it, we recognize that's a dog, that's a cat, that's my friend or my wife or my husband. And then we can judge it. We say that's a good sound, a bad sound, and we can judge the feelings and so on. All of the thoughts that go on in the mind, this is what we understand to be mind. So in general, we're not going to go into detail in our practice and try to see exactly what state the mind is in. But whatever state it's in, we're going to take this aspect of reality just to be the mind. So the easiest way to do this is when we think, when we're thinking, to just catch that up and to use our meditation and acknowledge thinking, as I'll explain in a second. Well, let's understand the mind to be basically thinking, the thinking about an object, or the thinking that arises in relation to the object. This is number three. Number four, I said I wasn't going to translate it because, well, it's a difficult word to translate. Actually, the word Dhamma simply means something that carries, or something that is carried, something that is held, something that holds or something that is held. And so the Buddha Dharma is the Dhamma, of what the Buddha holds to be his truth, or holds to be the truth. The Buddha held certain things to be truth, and that was called his Dhamma. Now, of course, we know the Buddha didn't hold them to be true. He experienced and understood them to be true. But still, in terms of society, they called that his Dhamma. Other people held other things to be true, and so they called that their Dhamma. Now, it can also mean something that holds its own existence. So the feeling in your body and the sensations and the pain and the happiness, the pleasure, and the thoughts, all of these hold their own existence in the sense that they do arise. They do really and truly arise. When you hear a dog barking, the sound arises. Now, the dog doesn't arise. All that arises is in your mind there's a thought, oh, that's a dog. But actually, the dog is never experienced. You will never experience dog. So dog is not a Dhamma in this sense, when we talk about something that holds its own existence, because this comes from the verb dharati, which means to hold or to carry. So this carries its own existence. This is the meaning of Dhamma. So there are two possible meanings here, and you can understand it both ways, and that's why I'm not going to translate it. We understand it as actually groups of the Buddha's teaching. So the Buddha taught certain things, this is real, and he taught what was going to arise when we practice meditation, and so these are his teachings, and he taught these things that arise will be for your benefit, these things that arise will be for your detriment, and these things will be an indication of your progress and should be developed and so on, should be encouraged, and these things will arise for your detriment, these things should be avoided, should be discarded and thrown away and so on. So on that end, we can think of these things as ethical qualities, in a sense. That's what we mean by Dhamma here. Or we can also think of it as all of reality. And I think actually most translators like to take this translation. They will say this is mind objects. They will translate Dhamma as mind objects, something the mind takes as an object. Now the problem I have with this, and this is just a technical problem, but for some of you this might be interesting, is that body, feelings, and mind are also Dhamma then. Because you take the body as a mind object, you take the feelings as a mind object, you even take the mind as a mind object. This is the technical reality of it. So we're not really distinguishing a fourth category at all, or we're having a great overlap here, which makes it confusing. And if you look at the layout of the fourth Satipatthana, it's quite clear that the Buddha laid it out in terms of his various teachings that he had given. So we can look at it both ways, but let's just say this is a group of things that the Buddha taught that are going to come into play in our practice. So we have these first three, and then the fourth one we have various states of mind, various phenomena that arise, good ones and bad ones that will arise in the mind, that we have to be able to distinguish, and we have to be able to analyze and acknowledge and see for what they are, because some of them will be good and some of them will be bad, some of them will be neutral, but they will give rise to ethical states as a result of our judgment, our experiencing of them. So let's just leave this one as Dhamma and understand it as certain sets of teachings or sets of phenomena. The first set, and this just to make it really easy and so that you don't get confused by what I just said, the first set is really the most important. It's the bad Dhammas, the Dhammas that the Buddha held to be unethical or to be in a sense, detrimental to our practice. So these are called the Nivarana. And if this is all, in the beginning, if this is all we understood Dhamma to be, then that's fine. That's enough, enough to get us started on the practice. So the Dhamma, the Nivarana Dhamma, the Dhammas that are going to be hindrances in our practice, are five. And they have very long Pali names, but to make it easy for our meditation, we understand them in very simple terms. Liking, disliking, drowsiness, distraction, and doubt. These are giving you very simple translations here, because these are going to be how we're going to acknowledge them. This will make it very easy for us to recognize them when we practice the meditation. So liking, sometimes we will like things, we experience something and we enjoy it, or we like it, or we hold on to it. Sometimes we will dislike things, we'll be angry or frustrated or upset by things. Sometimes we'll feel drowsy or tired, we'll feel like we're not able to catch the object up in our awareness, our mind is sluggish and so on. Sometimes we feel distracted, where our mind is too energetic and thinking about too many things and not able to focus on a specific object. And sometimes we will have doubt. We're not sure about what we're doing. Is the practice useful? We're not sure if we can. We doubt ourselves. Can we accomplish this? And so on. Doubting any aspect of the Buddha's teaching or so on, and giving rise to this unsure state of mind. These five dhammas are unethical, and we have to understand why they are unethical. They're unethical only because they are of a detriment to our mind state. Now, some people say, you know, doubting is actually good sometimes, because if you just believe everything, then you will believe bad things as well. But that's not the meaning of what we're talking about here. On a strictly phenomenological or experiential frame of reference, when you doubt something, it tears apart your mind, or it takes your mind, takes away the focus and the concentration of the mind. So actually, even if you believe something that is false, if you believe you want to kill someone and you believe it's a good thing to kill them, the faith that you have in that will actually be a good thing for you, in the sense that it will help you achieve your goal. Now, killing people is bad, and getting angry and wanting to do that is bad, but the confidence that you have is a positive in the sense that it helps you to carry out your task. So when the point here being that when we have doubt in our mind, if we have doubt about the meditation, it will stand in our way of carrying out our task. So this is what we mean by unethical or hindrances. They are things that are going to harm us or be to our detriment. When we have doubt, it's going to stop us from carrying out our tasks. Now, if we have bad tasks, then it's not that the faith that we have is going to be a good thing. It's actually going to be a harm, because it will help us carry out bad things. But the problem isn't the faith, and the doubt isn't good, but the act itself is the determining. So when we're practicing something good like meditation, it's very important that we have great faith in ourselves and faith in what we're doing. If you don't have that yet, then you should examine and you should study and you should ask teachers and so on and try to get good answers so that you are able to do away with the doubt, because it will stand in your way. All five of these will stand in your way. That's why they're called Nivarana, or hindrances. And this is the first group of dhammas. It's also the most important for beginners. A second group is the senses. So as I said, hearing, when you see something, when you smell something, but I don't want to get into too much detail. For those of you who have practiced before, you know about this anyway. For those of you who haven't, let's stick to the basics. So this is basically how we come to see clearly. We break reality up into little itty-bitty pieces, one moment at a time. And then we see it one moment at a time. We experience it and we evaluate it. We examine it. We meditate on it one moment at a time. As we do this, we're going to come to realize many things that we couldn't see before because we weren't looking, we weren't examining, we were simply following after or being led on by our experience, being led on by our habits, being led on by our preferences, our partialities, and so on. Now, once we come to look at things clearly and simply see them for what they are, we're going to it's going to open up many understandings and much wisdom for us. And that wisdom, in and of itself, will be enough to allow us to change. Because once you see that something is causing you harm, you will never ever do it again. You will never ever engage in something that you see clearly does you harm. And once you see that something does you good, on the other hand, your mind will naturally, due to that wisdom, naturally encourage it and naturally incline towards that sort of behavior. So this is what we mean by seeing clear. This is also the benefit of seeing clearly, that once you do, you will give up those things that are to your detriment, and you will take up those things that are to your benefit. So that's the first part of this program that I think is probably enough to allow us to now undertake a short practice. First of all, maybe I can confirm that you're all still there. Are we still connected?
Yes.
Okay.
So, can you give some instructions like on breathing and...
That's what I'd like to do next. So now we'll do a sort of a guided meditation together. So I assume you're all sitting, and we're going to try to do some sitting meditation. And we won't go into the walking meditation. I think that's much more difficult over the internet. Normally we'll put one hand on top of the other, but you're welcome to sit as you like. Some people put their hands out like this. The point is to not make it fancy or not to put too much emphasis on your posture, on a specific position, like have to sit like this, have to sit in the lotus position, have to put your hands up like this, or however. We normally sit like this simply because it's a very basic position. It's one that the Buddha took up, putting one hand on top of the other because they're then kept inward, closing your eyes and sitting in a ordinary cross-legged position. The easiest object for us to take in our meditation practice is the body. And all of the texts are clear about this, that this is what we should take first. Because, as I said, this is how most of us understand reality to be anyway. And it's how most of our experience is channeled through the body. But when you're sitting still, there's very little for us to take as an object. Now, this is good because we don't want too many things to be going on at once, but it's also a problem. We have to find something, at least something, to be mindful of. And what you should notice, if you're not too tense and not too stressed, is that when the breath comes into your body, your stomach will rise, maybe just slightly, but it should rise a little bit. And then when the breath goes out of the body, it will fall. Rise and fall. This should be natural. Now, if it's not clear, because for many of us we're quite tense and stressed due to our jobs and due to our obligations and so on, in the beginning you can try putting your hand on your stomach, and that'll allow you to experience the rising and the falling, at least in the beginning. Now, the way that we're going to go about examining impartially the objects of our experience is using this mantra, this word that we have. Now, a mantra normally is understood to be some spiritual or mystical word that we use to get in touch with something outside of ourselves, something external. But the fact of the matter is, a mantra is a useful tool to focus the mind and to keep the mind with the object. So we use this tool, but now we bring it back to focus on ourselves, to focus on our own experience. So when the stomach rises, we're going to use this mantra, this word, rising. Just a simple word, because that's what it is. And when we affirm for ourselves that that's what it is, our mind will be fixed on it and will be fixed on the reality of it. So we'll come to see that reality quite clearly. And our mind won't be able to give rise to liking or disliking or judgments or clinging. So this is what we're going to do. When the stomach rises, we're going to say to ourselves, rising. And when it falls, we're going to say to ourselves, fall. Rising, fall. Rising, falling, and so on. Maybe you can just try that now with me for a few minutes. It's important to understand that we're not trying to force the breath or control it to make it long or to make it smooth. We're simply going to watch it when it rises. We will note that as being rising. Remind ourselves this is rising. When it falls, we will remind ourselves this is falling. However it is. Now, as we do this, we will come to see that actually there's much more going on than simply the rising and falling. This is why we now come to see that we're not only our body, we're not just the physical. Because, as I said, there are more other parts. So the next one is the feelings. If we feel happy or pain or calm, we have to acknowledge this as well. We have to include this in our practice, so that we're able to see these experiences as they are as well, not judging or clinging or becoming attached to them either. So if we feel happy, we should say to ourselves, happy, happy. If we feel calm, we should say calm, calm. If we feel pain, we should focus on the pain, not try to run away or get upset by it, but simply to see it for what it is as pain. Say to ourselves, pain. Pain. And as we do this, we'll find that the tension and the stress vanishes, disappears. Because now we're no longer upset by it, we're no longer stressed out about it. And as we do this, our mind will become clear. And when the pain or the feeling goes away, we come back again to the rising and the falling. If we're thinking about things, we focus on the thought and say to ourselves, thinking, thinking. As I said, the third one is the mind, and whatever the mind is thinking, just see it simply. We don't have to go into great detail. This isn't a theoretical course. This is practical. So we don't need to understand exactly what kind of thought it is. There's no point. There's no benefit. Once we see clearly and objectively what something is, this is a thought. It doesn't matter what kind of thought. It is a thought. It's a specific type of reality. When we see that this is reality, it is what it is, that's enough. So we can simply say to ourselves, thinking, thinking, thinking. And that's easy because it will go away right away. Once it's gone, we come back again to the rising and falling. And as for the Dhammas, now you can see why I gave you simple names for them. Liking, disliking, drowsiness, distraction, and doubt. Because now we can very easily acknowledge and see clearly these things as well. So when you like something or you want something, you say to yourself, liking, liking. When you want something, wanting, wanting. If you dislike something, disliking, disliking, or angry, or frustrated, or bored, or sad, or so on. Simply say to yourself, bored, bored, depressed, or angry, or frustrated, frustrated. When you do this, you'll find the objectivity takes over, and there's no longer this subjectivity or the partiality, the aversion. And so the anger or the disliking disappears. If you feel drowsy, say to yourself, drowsy, drowsy, or tired, tired. If you feel distracted, say distracted, distracted. And both of these actually work to balance out the mind. If you feel drowsy, it will give you energy to say drowsy, drowsy. But if you feel distracted, it will give you concentration to say distracted, distracted. When you're thinking too much and your mind is not focused. And last, when you have doubt, the easiest way to overcome doubt, this is the best way to overcome all doubt, is to simply focus on the doubt and give up whatever it is you were doubting about. Say to yourself, doubting, doubting, and then your whole of your practice is focused on your doubt. And when you do that, you'll find there's nothing to doubt about, because this is doubt and that's a certainty. And therefore the doubt disappears. When these are gone, then you'll find your mind is much quieter, is much more focused, much more stable. And then you can come back and focus on the stomach again, rising, falling. When there's nothing else, we just focus on the stomach. If you see or hear or smell or taste or feel or think, the same technique goes. So seeing, seeing, hearing, hearing, and so on. Okay. Now I know we have limited time, so I'll leave it up to you. If you want to continue with the meditation, we can continue. If you want to start a discussion, if anyone has questions, I'm happy to answer them. But you'll have to come close to the mic because I...
Yes. I was talking to them.
Okay.
To see whether they had any questions and whether they understood the, your...
I feel like my feeling is like regulated, like I feel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like the breathing somewhat forced.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's actually part of what we're trying to understand. We're trying to come to realize our tendency to force things. We're trying to change this about ourselves, that we find it's actually true that in our lives we are this way. We try to force and we try to control people and the situations and our lives to be to our liking. Naturally, it's a habit. So what you're seeing here is how much suffering is involved in this. Because the technique is not to force or to control, but you find that by habit, when everything that we focus or put our attention on, we naturally try to force. So I only say this to encourage you to not be, or to not be discouraged by this. But if you continue in this way, eventually, what happens is your mind gives it up. Your mind says, "No, actually, this is stupid. It's useless for me to continue to force and to control my breath because that's not obviously what the technique is. The technique is simply to say, this is rising, this is falling, to know it for what it is." But as the mind is used to controlling and used to forcing, it's going to continue and again to try to force and try to control. Yes, now we have to make it rise, now we have to make it fall, and it's because of the misunderstanding that exists in the mind. And you'll find that as you go on, that is decreases and decreases until finally the mind just gives it up and says, you know, okay, let it go, it's going to rise, let it rise. Realizing that the correct way to live is to experience and interact rather than to force and control. What you're seeing is this is what is meant by anatta. You're starting to see the anatta nature or the non-self nature of things. It's not an intellectual or a theoretical teaching. It's this experiential and moment-to-moment realization of the true unmanageability of phenomenon, that control or the effort to control and to force and to create and to make things to be in a certain way is what causes us suffering. That's why the Buddha said sabbe sankhara anatta, na sabbe sankhara dukkha, that they're all suffering, that there is nothing that the sankhara is the formation. When we form and when we create things, it only creates suffering. So this is a sankhara that you're creating, this formation of a breath, or a formed breath, a controlled breath, and you can see that it's suffering. And as you see that again and again, you'll see anicchang dukkhang anatta clearer and clearer until the mind lets go, and then there is no, this problem that you have will disappear. So basically just continue on and understand that that's what you're experiencing. It's not a problem with the meditation. In fact, it's the great benefit of the meditation to be able to see and learn to overcome this. It's a sign that you're practicing correctly. Or in a sense, incorrectly, but coming to see what is incorrect, which is a good thing.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello. Hello.
Yes, yes. Yeah, yeah. In this context, most people don't translate it as the Buddha's teaching. And in the Buddha's teaching, or in the text that we have, the word Dhamma is given a second meaning, and the Buddha himself gave it another meaning. He said, "Sabbe dhamma dukkhati," all dhammas are suffering. So what does that mean? It's not actually referring, or "Sabbe dhamma anatta," sorry, it's referring all dhammas are non-self. So he's not referring here to his teaching. He's referring to something else. And this is because the Buddha gave this new meaning to the word Dhamma, which is something which carries its own nature. And so why he does this is because what is the Buddha's teaching? The Buddha's teaching is reality. What the Buddha held to be true is reality. The Buddha didn't hold some teaching like God or the dharmas of the Buddha's time were the dharmas of the warrior. The warrior class had this dharma, so they held it to be true, or they held it to be proper to kill, to fight and to go to war, and this was their dharma, this was their code, their behavior. Now, what the Buddha held to be true was an understanding of reality. It wasn't that if you kill and if you do your duty, you're going to go to heaven. The Buddha said, no, that's not the true dharma, because it's not real. It's not true that if you kill, you're going to go to heaven. He said, that's not reality. So when the Buddha examined reality, he was able to break it down into experiences, moments. And so a dharma is actually a moment, a reality. So that's why I said everything is, every part of the four satipatthana, everything that we experience is actually a dharma. But if you, in this context, if you translate it in that way, then you have a problem, because then all four satipatthanas are actually dharmas. They're all realities. So the body is, each bodily experience is a reality, each feeling is a reality, and so on. So it gets muddled. I had to say that because most people translate it in that way, and it is a proper way to translate it. But the easiest way for us to understand it is as you understand it, as the Buddha's teaching. So here we have the fourth one. The dharmas are the method of practice that the Buddha laid out. So you have the first three, and then the practical teachings of the Buddha on the hindrances, and we're going to have to be mindful of the hindrances that I explained. The senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, thinking, we're going to have to be mindful of those, because that's where all experience arises, and so on. We're going to have to be mindful of the aggregates and bodhjangas are the path of practice, the factors of enlightenment, the factors of enlightenment, and so on. So I think the way you understand it is fine. It's just important to understand that the teachings of the Buddha are in essence, and it's an important understanding, are in essence individual realities or individual experiences. So every true Dhamma is some reality, that's something that arises and ceases, or something that exists, sorry, not that arises and ceases, because Nibbana or Nirvana is actually a Dhamma, because it exists in reality. It holds its own existence, so it's a Dharma. Dharma means to hold, not to carry. So it carries its own existence. That's the technical meaning. I hope I haven't confused you too much. The easiest way is to just understand it's the five hindrances, you know, liking, disliking, drowsiness, distraction, and doubt, and the six senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, thinking. If you can be mindful of those, then you don't have to understand the whole technical classification of the word Dhamma. Just understand the Dhamma is these two things, practice them, and you'll get a benefit. Otherwise, you'll just maybe get too confused. If you really want to know, you can go and study the two different meanings of the word Dhamma by studying the Buddha's teaching. Because there are two distinct meanings, at least. Hope that helps.
When we hear that, and then you said the dog is not reality, but only the hearing is the reality.
Right.
And what were you trying to teach us? Like, why the dog is not reality? That is something existing. And,
sure.
And why, as far as I'm concerned, only the hearing.
Yeah, well, I didn't go into too much detail because it's hard for people. I mean, for those of you who have practiced, it's easy to understand, but for new people, it's hard to understand that kind of a teaching. Now, what I was talking about is the difference between ultimate reality and conceptual reality. Now, the dog is a concept, but the way we can understand this as beginners coming into the practice is that reality, and therefore our practice of examining and understanding reality is based on experience, is based on moment-to-moment experience. Now, you can never experience dog. If you think about it, you never experience something that is dog, that is a dog. What you experience is a sound, a sight, a smell, a taste, a feeling, or a thought. You experience something physically or you experience something mentally. The only way a dog comes into play is when a thought arises, or a picture arises in the mind that you recognize, and there's a recognition that says, this is a dog. But that's just an experience that arises. The dog never really enters into the picture. There's no dog that arises, so it's not a Dhamma.
It's only a
perception.
It's only a perception.
Yes, yes. It's a recognition, perception, yeah. Or apperception, I'm not sure what the correct technical definition is. Sanya, no? The Pali word is sanya. So we know. So when you hear something, don't say dog, dog, dog. Or barking, barking, that doesn't work. You have to go according to your experience. So this involves a shift, and a very important shift, in our understanding, in our relationship or our cognizance of an experience. Rather than looking at our day-to-day experience in terms of objects and concepts, we have to begin to open up to this new way of looking at things in terms of momentary experiences. It's actually quite a paradigm shift for most people, especially if you aren't familiar with the Buddhist teaching. But it really opens you up to much more scientific and much more useful or beneficial way, the enlightening way of looking at reality.
Rather than focusing on my sleep, I just focus on my hurting, I mean, basically back pain. So if I'm always thinking it's hurting and pain, so it's basically distracted from trying to, I mean, focus on my breathing style. So is it
Sure. Sure, it's okay. You can also change postures, especially in the beginning. You know, when you get really into the meditation, eventually you'll want to just bear with it and see it through until finally the mind gives it up and lets go. But in the beginning, it's much more beneficial, I think, to find a posture which is comfortable for you, that where you don't have an intense pain. You can even do the meditation lying down, or obviously sitting against the wall is possible. Sitting in a chair is certainly possible. And you can slowly work towards, you should think of it as working towards a proper sitting meditation, whether you ever reach it or not. Just don't get more and more convenient, where you find yourself less and less endurant of the pain. But in the beginning, you can think of it as a temporary crutch to sit in a chair or sit against the wall, sit on a little bench or something, find a way to alleviate the pain somewhat. You can never really get rid of it, and that's the delusion we want to be free from. Don't ever think that you'll somehow get rid of the pain and you'll find a posture that's perfect or so on. Try to be at least accepting of a little bit of pain, but if it's unbearable, if it's too much, and if it's really just creating stress and suffering, then in the beginning you can make it easy on yourself and slowly work into the point where you're able to sit and endure the pain, and it's not too much. So you can really go either way. There's no, meditation is just meditating. No, it's just examining and analyzing or experiencing objectively, observing the reality objectively. So you can do that in any way. Whatever way helps you in the beginning to do that and to progress further towards an objective experience of reality, then that's fine. You can adjust. But there's, if you like, you can just focus on the pain. There's no need to focus on the stomach. You have to see where you're at in your meditation.